Welcome to the FASD Success Show, the only podcast where you can get real-world information about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This show will help you create calm in the chaos, have hope for the future, and more importantly, save your sanity so you don't lose your flipping mind. Now, here's your host, caregiver turned world FASD educator, Jeff Noble.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the FASD Success Show, episode number 57. I'm your host, Jeff Noble. Thank you so much for being here. Whether this is your first episode or your 57th episode, thank you. This is the podcast that is all about creating FASD success, whether it be individuals on the spectrum, caregivers taking care of the individuals on the spectrum, frontline workers who are supporting everybody. Does not matter if you are around individuals on the spectrum. This is the place to be because I talk to people who are doing amazing things in the realm, in the world of FASD, and I just try to get what they know. I try to get those little juicy nugget tidbits of knowledge, those little golden nuggets of information, so you could leave here and every show with either something new, learning something new, something reinforced, and just some inspiration, all that good stuff. And today, my friends, today will be no different. Today, we have the most popular guest in terms of downloads returning once again. We have Dr. Mansfield Mella, and oh boy, he's going to bring the fire because we are talking about his new book. His new book called Prenatal Alcohol Exposure, A Clinician's Guide. This 457-page just stack of awesome info is available now, and we're going to talk about it because it's for clinicians, but it's you could read it. The way they set up the book is fantastic. We talk about clinicians' role. We talk about why there isn't much of an understanding in terms of FASD in that realm, and what he wants to do about it. And a part of his writing his book was to bridge that gap from clinicians and mental health workers don't know to making them comfortable with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So I don't want to take up too much time, but I just want to check in, obviously, and I hope you're doing splendid. And whether you're walking or listening while you're driving or doing the dishes or vacuuming or hiding in some little cubbyhole just to get some peace and quiet while you listen, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. You know what would really help? If you haven't already, to subscribe. The more subscribers we can get, the more it tells the algorithms that we're doing something awesome. So when somebody searches for FASD and podcast, boom, we pop up. Awesome. So I really appreciate that. If you want to even go one further, we know that reviews also help. Good review, some good feedback, that would be great too. But that's it. That's all I have in terms of a shameless self-promotion. I'm sure I got more, and I'll probably say it later. But I hope you're doing well. We're pushing into spring now. Even though I live in northeastern Ontario, it's still cold. It's still cold, but one day we'll get some plus temperatures. It's not as cold, but this is what I get for living here. Not a big deal. I'm pretty proud of where we live. We love it. Okay, so if you haven't yet heard the man we're about to talk to, you could go back to the earlier rendition of the FASD Success Show, and I think it's actually episode number 16, and Dr. Mella's podcast with me about understanding aggression is like the highest downloaded podcast that I have. So that's episode number 16. He did the podcast on aggression, but we've also worked together before when he and his team and other professionals created the first medication algorithm for FASD. So if you just Google that, FASD medication algorithm, I know I have a free training up, and Ken FASD has information. It's getting out there now, so that's good. But now he's on to something new. He's written a book, and I'm excited to get to this. So who is Dr. Mella? Well, real quick, I'm going to run down his bio. Dr. Mella is he's not an associate professor. I got to change that. Dr. Mella is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Saskatchewan. His clinical practice is out of the Forensic Outpatient Clinic at the University of Saskatchewan and the Forensic Inpatient Service at the Regional Psychiatric Center, Saskatoon. Dr. Mella's recent research studies include psychiatric drug use in sex offenders, FASD in forensic populations, neurotoxic metals in aggressive patients, spirituality and religiosity in forensic patients. He also created the FASD, who is part creator, we got to give everybody credit, of the FASD medication algorithm. He's a super nice dude. He knows his stuff. This is a 10 timer. Get ready. You're going to have to listen over and over because he drops so many knowledge bombs. You'll have to be in a bunker. All right, let's get to the interview. Let's go. Okay, folks, here I am. He's absolutely the number one rated guest in terms of downloads. I don't know if you knew that, Dr. Mella, but besides my first episode, your episode is number two. Welcome back to the show as a repeat guest. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Jeff. Always a nice welcome from you, and great to be speaking to so many people who I'm desiring to work together with to make life better for those with FASD. Thank you, Jeff.
Well, you're very welcome. And so we don't need any introduction. We know that you know. If you need to know about Dr. Mella a little bit more, you could certainly check out our episode with Dr. Mella and aggression. And that is super popular. But you know what we're talking about today? We're talking today about your book, Doctor. We're talking today about, this is almost undercover, I feel like, because A, you told me you went on sabbatical, but B, you didn't tell me what you were doing. You were just doing research. How come you didn't spill the beans, man?
So I was a first timer in writing a book, and I had to make sure that I got the approval that the book was going to be okay before I announced it. So I was walking behind the scene. I knew I had to write the book, but I also wanted to be sure that it was going to be something good before I announced it. So
Jeff, I'm sorry.
It was a deliberate plan. So
okay. But let's talk about that. So bring me to where it becomes a thought, to where it becomes, you know, you assemble the appropriate people. Like, take me a little bit around that timeline for when you got the belief that, you know, I can and I need to do this.
So first and foremost, the idea did not come to me until probably about 5 years ago. As you know, I've traveled the field of FASD, I've done presentations, I've interacted with individuals with FASD, with families that have cared for people with FASD, and more importantly for this reason, with clinicians that knew very little about FASD. I am one of those. I would never deceived anybody. I've spent 14 years practicing medicine without knowing anything about FASD. So I'm not alone in this. And I knew, I wished I had gotten this information that I'm writing to clinicians about, on how to interact with individuals with FASD and how to help them. So the idea was there about 5 years ago, but as I mentioned, I'm not someone who has written a book before. So I got a chance to write a chapter in a book about FASD and the criminal justice system. It was published in 2016. And thereafter, I realized that we cover a lot of the things in that book about the legal system, but I was more particular about the clinical, psychiatric, and mental health system, that there are people there that need to know how to interact with people with FASD. Now, I must tell you one instance that probably pushed me over the edge.
That was my next question, yeah.
Right. I had a presentation. You know that we did some work on the algorithm, and it was in Saskatoon in 2016, October. I will never forget. After we had advertised everything, I got talking to a clinician that will remain nameless, and the clinician told me he knew what FASD was, and this was a waste of time that we were spending hours calling people away from their work, talking about people that we use hours to diagnose when we could just see 10 people in 1 hour. Mm-hmm. That was very upsetting, and I thought, we need to educate people, not in an angry way, but to say we cannot go around spreading this kind of misinformation that this is not important. So that was one of the kickers that I said, you know what, we need to address clinicians specifically. We need to guide them. And one of the reasons is that many people feel they know about FASD. Many people feel that FASD doesn't change their treatment plan, that there's nothing, there's no additional value in knowing that the person has FASD. And that's something that I sought to debunk through writing this book.
So let's talk about that, because then, you know, you went 14 years, you're saying, so there's a sense of urgency, a little bit of frustration, right? Because knowing what you didn't know, now you know, and it's changed your practice. It's, you know, changed your life, the way you look at people and in your own being of a doctor and seeing patients. So where was, like, did you not believe you could do it at first? Or were you worried about the undertaking? You said, I had to make sure it was good first. So here's my question to you is, when I look at you and I see a professor, a psychiatrist, there's more letters after your name than the alphabet. So why did, like, so, where was that gap of believing that you could do such a thing?
So first and foremost, writing a book for, and during the course of my writing, I've come across people who have written books. It is a very stressful event. I mean, you're all on your own, you yes. and your thoughts, you want to communicate something, you don't know whether you're communicating the right way. And I am more in the way of practically doing something rather than communicating about it. And so that was one of the challenges I was having. And so it was first an internal question about my abilities, but also the people that I was seeking to influence, because we are talking about people with degrees more than mine that I'm telling them, look,
who are these
you guys
people?
Yeah, you these? Guys there are many people with degrees more than mine, and I'm trying to tell them, hey, you missed the boat, there's something called FASD you need to pay attention to, and I need to be able to communicate appropriately. And I must say, I had a lot of help along the way, and I remain very grateful to so many people that ensured that this actually turned out the way it turned out. And I'm also very pleased because the publisher is a highly scientifically based publisher. So you are kind of in between. This material needs to be done and brought down to a basic level, but also it has to be scientific enough with all the evidence to support what I was saying that would be appealing to those that needed to hear.
Am I, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the American Psychiatric Society?
Yes, it's called the American Psychiatric Association. And so they have a publishing company known as the APA Publishing.
Oh, that's the big time. And so did you have to convince the publisher that this was legit?
Yes and no. And I'll tell you how that process came about. Yeah. If you want to write a book, and I knew my sabbatical was coming when I made the decision I'm going to write a book. And I said, you know what, I'm just going to try my luck, because these individuals in American Psychiatric Association, they have a very strong journal. And I wrote my article believing that they were going to agree to publish the algorithm, and they rejected it. So I knew what I was coming across and say, you know what, they are not even keen to FASD to start with. But I had an inkling that they recognize FASD in the DSM. They are the ones that published the DSM, by the way. So I wrote out my outline, what I was hoping to communicate, and I met with this amazing editor who called our team together. They listened to me, and I must say, there was something that they were very, very interested in, and it's probably the longest chapter there. It's about the exposure to multiple substances. They were not only interested about alcohol alone, but they said it's very rare for you to have only alcohol exposure. So you need to do a lot of work on multiple exposure. So that's how they did, and they actually made the decision that I was going to write to them, and then it would go through the peer review and then their own editing before it got published. So
wow. They had to convince them. You wrote it. peer-reviewed editor, and right. So until here we are.
Absolutely.
Yes. That's amazing. And now, as I'm reading it, and you're giving a little bit of the backstory, it's a hilarious picture because you know, where are you from? You live in Saskatoon, but where are you from originally?
I'm from Nigeria.
So, folks who aren't watching the video but listening to this in your car or running, so you have a Nigerian man in the prairies in Canada in the deep winter at a family friend's residence yourself writing this book. So, you know, can you relate when you watch the movies of the troubled authors alone in their study now, doctor, right? You can say, oh, I get it, how tough it is now.
I really get it, Jeff. I mean, there were times of fatigue, times of lack of creativity, lack of identified topic to write about, and just tiredness. I'm almost wanting to give up. But there were also very interesting points. I mean, I couldn't capture all of it in the preface. But so my friend who was in Thailand enjoying himself during that winter gave me his house, and his house is next to our forestry farm where we have animals. And he was encouraging me, you know, when you get tired, go out and enjoy the snow and enjoy the animals. It was so cold, I couldn't even dare go out, you know. So it was a really interesting period. So when he came back, and of course he didn't come back during the winter, he came back after, and I was telling you, that offer was not an offer that I could take. So you can imagine that.
I just picture this Nigerian man in the middle of winter in the prairies riding by, and you must be like, what am I doing? What?
I know. You're all on your own, your thoughts and with your cold.
Oh my gosh. But so all alone, that means big support from your family.
Oh, I cannot thank my wife and my three boys for just hanging in there. They were praying for me, saying, okay, dad is going to write his book. We understand. And yeah, it was really a lot of support from her, a lot of support from friends that decided, you know what, this guy has told us that he doesn't trust himself to do it. We're going to pray for him. And they did. I mean, like, people call from time to time. And remember, when I'm writing, I'm cutting off from people, right? I can only email, no phone calls, nothing. And so during the emails, you see people saying, how much have you written today? How are you doing? You know, there were people that were offering to take me out for a meal or something. And I'm saying, not now, not now. You know, so there were people that really were very tolerant and very supportive throughout the process. It was an experience, and I'm grateful for going through it.
And you're grateful that it's over.
It's absolutely.
It is a mixture. So let's talk about it. And I wanted to go through a few things here. And because remember, parents are make up a majority of my audience that will be listening to this. So how can, because it's 457 pages, like it's not small. It's not nighttime stand reading. So like, this is meant to get into the professionals' hands. And I want to talk about, you know, some ideas about how we can do this, but there's a few things that I wanted to cover in your book right here. Okay, here we go. I made notes because I'm a professional like that. Here's what I wanted to ask. Okay, this book provides clinically relevant information for mental health experts, but it goes beyond that to provide sufficient content to improve clinicians' level of comfort with information to which they have not been exposed to. That's unique, doctors. So you want them to be comfortable with this information. Do you believe that they're not diagnosing it or not addressing it because they don't understand it and so they aren't comfortable with it? Like, why did you choose that sort of feeling associated with your book?
In part, I think some of the reasons why we don't diagnose, and I can identify with that, has to do with the lack of comfort of the diagnosis. There are a lot of myths about FASD that would discourage clinicians from engaging with it. I just gave you an example of a clinician that was telling me what a waste of time we were spending time. I don't take that at face value. I think that there are other things that are driving such a comment, and most of it has to do with, one, the absence of the knowledge. I've said this over and over again. Not only were we not taught, we were never put in a position to deal with individuals with FASD. That's one. Secondly, training, especially for mental health professionals, has not always been focused on the origin of the problem. It has almost always been, what are the symptoms of the problem? So once you throw in etiology or the cause of the problem, my training causes me to become shaky. Like, this is not what I'm used to. So what this book was hoping to communicate was, there are significant advances in the area of FASD, not only for head knowledge, but that you can use that knowledge and be able to help your client. Now, recall that the book is written in such a way that almost every chapter, and this is what I credited to the APA, they said you must use clinical examples to make your point, so that you as a clinician will look and say, this individual that Dr. Mela has put in the book is not different from the person that I was dealing with. This young example of a young adolescent looks like the one that I dealt with yesterday. This person who is just being released from prison looks like the one that I released last week, so that you can identify with it and say, I can actually do better than I did before. I'm more comfortable in dealing with the case. So for parents trying to understand where the book is coming from, yes, it is very scientific, but it is clinically based. It is based on what we call vignettes. So every chapter has, including history, has a vignette about individuals with FASD. Most of them, which is I'm grateful to, are based on some of the examples that I have dealt with. I mean, without any identifying characteristic, you know.
But the points, at the start of the chapter, you put points, which is it's a bonus. This is what I'm trying to say. And this is, you know, the text that is going to back up what I'm saying. So absolutely.
Right.
This isn't a 30-second answer, but I'm going to try and extract one from you. Right. It just doesn't make sense that in psychiatry, functioning isn't first, symptoms are.
Well, it's probably historical, because as you can imagine, when the whole idea of psychiatry began, it was supposed to be have no basis in physical health. It was like esoteric. It was just something out there, right? And so over time, it has been very difficult to gain the ground to make the point that there's actually something pathologically and fundamentally wrong with the brain. And even up till today, the field is totally divided, you know, because some people insist that this is purely brain-based. Some people say, no, there's actually nothing about brain, when you can't actually separate the two. The two are intricately linked. And so this is an area whereby over time, we're beginning to gain the grounds that be comfortable with function, be comfortable with etiology, not only the symptom. Like the saying goes, why deal with the tip of the iceberg when the whole foundation of the iceberg has not been uprooted? So this is one of the areas that is important for clinicians to know about.
And so just so folks know,
Etiology
is the cause or the set of causes, the manner of causation of a disease or condition. I have to let the audience know, because that they might be, what is that? That's my job to break it down a little bit more.
Thank you for helping. And you can see already, as a clinician, I'm trained and almost wired to speak in the language I understand. So when you come to tell me to change my language, as I'm telling people to change their approaches, it's going to make you uncomfortable. So I'm giving you the confidence to know that this material will make you more comfortable.
I agree. I felt smart reading it. I'll tell you that, right? Because I know. Because you give the terms and you stick to the terms, and the glossary isn't as thick as the Bible. Like, you have some specific terms that keep showing up over and over again. So it's easy for the reader who even has taken even a little bit of information about FASD. Because of a large number of individuals with neurobehavioral disorders associated with PAE, prenatal alcohol exposure / FASD also manifest overlapping features of mental disorders or have additional mental disorder diagnosis. Advocating for a separate system that addresses their specific needs has lasting implications and benefits.
Right.
So are you suggesting, like, for individuals on the spectrum, a different system?
You know, I'm kind of suggesting that, recognizing the challenges, but I'm also proposing and advocating for individuals to school themselves to not wait for that system. I'm saying this would be ideal, but until that ideal is pie in the sky comes to fruition, I need you to step up your game, so to say, and recognize these individuals in your office. You know, quickly, Jeff, as you know, we've done this study and looked at how many individuals know that they have FASD when they enter into a study. Only about 10% of individuals know. You know, after the study, close to 80% of those who have FASD only discover that because you've done the study. We know that all the time, that through your office as a clinician, there are people who are walking in and out that have FASD, whether you know it or you don't know it. And so the whole idea of a new system is great, but when is that system going to be developed? We are saying you are the system. You are the person. When that door opens, let the person with FASD meet you well-informed, as if you've created a system that looks ideal for the FASD. So that's what that sentence is referring to. We would love to have a system that everybody in the path knows about FASD and approaches FASD in a modified way and deals with individuals in that right way. But we know we are far off from that system, at least economically, and as well, you know, fundamentally, just systems don't get newly developed anymore. So we are trying through this book to say to individuals, consider yourself that system. You are the door that was opened. You are the one that can help this person to achieve their goals of functioning as a contributing member of society.
Yeah, yeah, well said. There, yeah, but it's where the rubber meets the road, and they need to be the rubber. And I always say you can't wait for the government or this white knight to come in and say, here's all the accommodations and here's all the interventions. The parents, when I speak to the parents, they must, right? It's up to them to create the stable placement at home. And then you're saying to the clinicians and the mental health workers, it's up to them to get educated to make the lives better of the individuals on the spectrum. We can't wait for the perfect system.
That's correct. Absolutely.
So your book is published by the American Psychiatric Association.
That's correct. Right?
Okay, Association. Who published the DSM-5?
That's correct.
Which is the Diagnostic Standards or Statistic Manual?
Statistical Manual.
Okay. And yeah. So this is where the diagnoses come from when a patient sees a psychiatrist, and it is included. But you know what drives me? So now they say it's prenatal alcohol exposure. What's the actual NDPAE, right? Yeah. So you use this in your book a lot, NDPAE. But it's, so if we know the numbers of FASD in terms of prevalence, if, you know, it's 2.5 times more prevalent than autism, then why the heck does it say it needs further study? Why is it in the back of the book when it's supposed to be leading the parade in most cases?
Thank you, Jeff. The issue of diagnosis is a tough one, and I hope parents will just bear with the explanation. Consider it an evolving event. It's not going to be static. It has never been static. I've written about this. The relationship between the DSM and FASD has been one of almost what I call hate and love, because two editions started without any FASD coming into it. Then FASD came into one of the editions, and by the next edition, it was thrown out. And now it is very, very likely it has come to stay, because many people have realized it. There was a committee looking at the FASD diagnosis. Now, this was a compromise. They just had to get a compromise because there was a lot of sufficient information to make it into a diagnosis. Now, again, you need to understand when you talk about a mental disorder, there is a definition for that. And sometimes the stigma associated with it is too much to now add on somebody with FASD. And so that's why, to try and help it, they decided, let's start with a condition for further study. It's not as if there's not enough studies. There is. Before you get a place in the diagnosis, they want to make sure you can show the data. Remember, I told you mental diagnosis started as a matter that had nothing to do with the brain. And over time, it has something to do with the brain. And now, for you to convince the DSM to put a diagnosis that has an etiology, as Jeff read, is a new concept. It's going to change everything that we know in mental health. So it's just an evolution. I think by the time we get to the next DSM series, it's very likely we will be having the diagnosis fully in the middle. Now, that's not to say you cannot make the diagnosis with the DSM as it is right now, because there is a section known as neurodevelopmental disorder unspecified that allows you to diagnose somebody with FASD. But we just want a full criteria that recognizes it as a disorder. Just again, let me just encourage people who may be unsatisfied with the APA is to recognize that the criteria that the APA is using, called the super domains, is actually one that is recognized by every person who does FASD diagnosis. So the criteria of adaption, adaptability of mood regulation and hyperactivity and impulsivity are the core features in almost all the diagnostic systems. So APA has actually come around in a very intriguing way. It's just that they've not moved it into the cycle, but we still have another way of diagnosing it. So and there's that, a bit of politics.
5 years, the DSM, so, or what's...
Good point. So for people who do not know, it was previous to now, everything has changed, by the way, Jeff. Previous to now, the idea was that every 5 to 10 years, the DSM should be updated. But because of the speed at which knowledge is coming, they've now changed it. So that's why we changed the name. If everybody sees it, it used to be Roman numerals, but now it's Arabic numerals. So it's DSM-5, and the next one is going to be DSM-5.1, not DSM-6. So that they are not having to wait. As far as we have knowledge, we're going to move forward. So if you, for whatever reason, get called to participate in a research that would look at the validity of diagnosis, I would encourage you to participate, because that would move the science ahead.
Okay, so we know one of the arguments against FASD is lack of comfort, lack of information. When you're sitting across, what is the argument against FASD?
So most of it has to do with just the lack of knowledge, the lack of comfort. The other things which are, again, myths in my opinion, is one, it is not treatable. So people say, well, once the disorder is not treatable, then it doesn't belong in a doctor's office. Okay? And so that's another thing. But we know that diabetes is not treatable. You know, you can't cure diabetes. You can only care for somebody who has diabetes. So why is it in a doctor's office? So it's a matter of combining all these factors together to help people realize that you can be comfortable, you know, and that's the issue there. The other thing that also people don't realize is that, at least I can use myself as an example, is that I think I'm doing the person a favor by helping them. And so if I cannot do them the favor, there's no need for me to help them. When it is the reverse, when you treat the person adequately, I'm actually doing myself a favor. So until that light shines in people's minds, it remains an argument, because I cannot do a favor. I can't help you. When in reality, if I can treat you well, you can get better, I'm doing myself a favor. But it's a counterintuitive point that I hope clinicians who are listening will recognize that when you know what modifications to use for an individual with FASD, the person does better and your own stress level goes down. I'm a first-hand candidate of that.
You're improving their quality of life. So when an
life easier.
When an amputee comes in, right, they can't get the limb back, but you can make their life better by giving them a prosthetic.
That's an excellent example. And once that person has a prosthetic and goes away without coming to your clinic next week, guess what? You've done yourself a favor.
Yeah, absolutely. So
that's a great example.
Because you're in that mindset. Now let's talk a little bit about clinical management here. I made this point. The diagnostic consequences of prenatal alcohol exposure and the mental disorders emanating from minor or major contributions of prenatal alcohol exposure are interrelated. You say quite literally, the flow of expression of prenatal alcohol exposure intermingles with risk factors of mental disorder to produce a plethora of consequences.
That's correct.
Now tell me like I'm fine.
That's right. So what I'm trying to say is that do not exclude FASD and put it away because you think it is unrelated to your field of psychiatric practice, because every of your psychiatric problem, when you put it on the same table of the reasons why the person is in front of you, you cannot separate that from somebody with FASD. Start from their early life, the experience of prenatal problems, the experience of postnatal problems, the experience of childhood problems, the experience of adolescent dysfunction, the experience of medical problems, social determinants of health, for example, poor housing, lack of identity, lack of role models, trauma in the person's life. We see that all the time in our individuals with mental disorder. And those things are not disparate or dissimilar to those people with FASD. So don't exclude people with FASD. Take an interest, because you're going to find almost the same kind of background that your patients that you see with schizophrenia, with depression, with anxiety, with OCD, with post-traumatic stress disorder, they have a similar trajectory. So literally, the features that contribute to mental disorder are literally the same symptoms that contribute to FASD. The only difference is that there are situations whereby the impact of the alcohol use is so overwhelming that it interferes with the person's development beyond the person that you're seeing with other diagnoses. But those people with other diagnoses may still have an influence of prenatal alcohol exposure. Jeff, I hope I'm making the point.
No, I'm that listening.
I'm trying for people to not exclude this, because this is like your bread and butter. You must be dealing with the same people. The skills you use to deal with somebody with schizophrenia, you can still use with this. You have to modify it, but don't say, oh no, I can't do anything about this individual, because the skills that you need are going to be applicable here.
It would be best if clinicians ruled FASD out first instead of including it last.
You know what? This is my desire. I wish, and I was just speaking, by the way, to some people that were beginning to write an article with together, and this particular psychiatrist made this mention that, look, I have done this because I have an interest in developmental problems. So the first thing that comes to my mind is that, is there FASD first? And if there is not, then I go on to other things. And indeed, Jeff, this point you made is exactly what we teach in medical school. There are certain things you must rule out, things with causes, okay? So if you have somebody who has some problems and you're suspecting there is a cause here, well, that's the first thing you go after. But unfortunately, because of what we said earlier, that the symptoms have taken major position and priority over the etiology, and we wish we can go back to that, and I know we will go back there with advancing science.
but it's this isn't all the clinician's fault either, because the way the system's set up right now, and I know you mentioned this before, a doctor has 7 minutes with a patient. A patient is saying a symptom, right? And so a patient is saying, like, I'm angry or I'm depressed, and the patient doesn't understand, hey, listen, my HPA is out of whack, and I'm having trouble with my cognition and my auditory processing. So they come out with the symptoms, and there's not enough time to really dig deeper.
The system definitely contributes to the problem. The other thing is that if we can get clinicians to understand how the system disadvantages them, we can begin to make changes to say, it is not appropriate for me to see certain patients only in 7 minutes. It is not appropriate for me to see certain patients with this limited amount of information. I need more information. So I think we are on the cusp of recognizing these difficulties, because it has already begun to happen in other areas. So for example, you have this situation whereby a clinic is called complex case clinics, and they recognize that you cannot tell people to come and tell you one or two symptoms for that day. They need to be able to list everything, because you cannot treat them in isolation. You need to be able to do that. And something similar to a complex disorder like FASD needs to be thought of as we move forward.
So one of the things in your book, I want to talk about this, you use like this term, this explanatory term for FASD. So we, you know, not only do we want to inform and educate, but we want to help. We want to give some practical stuff to the people who are listening. So if they're in their clinician's office, either as an advocate or maybe they're an individual on the spectrum, and they say FASD, and that they might not be comfortable with that, know the full realm of the scope of what's going on, but instead you said the term is a diffuse neurocognitive damage. Now, if somebody went in and advocated and used that word instead of FASD, do you think that would have a more of an impact? Because the clinician would know diffuse brain damage over the other term?
You know, it is unlikely, Jeff, and I'll tell you why. The concept of diffuse cognitive damage was, again, another compromise. You know, it's very unfortunate that we've been struggling to almost get an identity for FASD in the medical field. And so if you go back many years, FASD was initially developed and defined based on the physical characteristics, the face, the body, the weight. Yep. And over time, we realized actually we're missing a large population because we're not focusing on the brain. Once we embraced the brain, the question was, okay, what exactly in the brain is the problem? And we're having to deal with 10 domains that have different permutations. And so you cannot define a single profile. And so we've tried to say, okay, is it executive functioning, language and memory that defines it? Is it this and that? And so all of those have created a need for a better way of communicating within clinicians. So rather than saying, okay, this group have abnormality of executive function, memory, and language, and that group has arithmetic, English, and whatever, we said, look, the best we can say right now is that the damage is diffuse, is everywhere. Now, I would not encourage people to use that to doctors. First, because, as I said, it's a compromised position. Okay. Secondly, a lot of people would not know. If you're not in the FASD field, you wouldn't know that.
Wouldn't even know that, huh?
You wouldn't know that. And so the best thing is to even just describe that there is a potential. Even using the word brain damage may even be better than a diffuse cognitive damage. So that's what I would say about that.
Yeah, and I was just looking for language that clinicians spoke and understood over a more confusing term. That's where I was going. But again, now that you mentioned that, that it's a compromise, one day we will not make compromises and we'll make headway.
That is That is the goal. The goal is the research that we're doing right now, identifying neuroimaging deficits, identifying some of the confluence of cognitive domains together to define a profile in the future, especially with artificial intelligence and deep machine learning. We are getting there. We will get there. And there are certain people like Dr. McLaughlin that is working on that. And we would be able to look and say, you know what? This is what FASD really looks like. We have lots of things that are going on. So that, don't despair. We've started this journey. There's no going back. We will be able to get to the place.
Yeah, there's some really exciting things that you even listed in your book, because as we know, an assessment is expensive and extensive, and it involves a whole team to make a diagnosis. But you talked about research, and I also heard this from Dr. James Reynolds from Kids Brain Health. I don't know if it's the same, about psychotic eye movements.
Right.
By so, watching a video and watching, can you explain that? You probably better than me.
So circadic eye movement is the way your eye moves across the visual field. So you can put some, and the way the research is done is that you sit in a room that is dark, and there will be a light that is shining, a pointed light that is shining, and then your eye is supposed to stay focused on that. But in certain people, because of what we think is the loss of control of the muscles that control the eye, that is very closely linked to the damage to the frontal lobe, the eye will shake a little bit more than the normal. And so far, this particular test seems to be able to differentiate not only those with FASD from normals, but also those from FASD from ADHD. I mean, that is just phenomenal. So we are on that cusp, and hopefully over time, you begin to see that we can use what we call biomarkers and neuroimaging techniques to be able to identify those who are more likely to have FASD than not. So we are on that way.
Because as it stands right now, a singular MRI isn't an indicator for a diagnosis to see. We've been talking to Dr. Catherine LaBelle. You need a lot of images, you know, to see the slight changes, right?
That's
because diffuse. It's when was the alcohol ingested? What was mom's genetics like? What was like her epigenetics like? You know, how much stress was she under? What was her nutrition? All these factors. Where does she live? All these factors contribute to this disability. So it's really confusing to know that, you know, we are trying, and the science is trying to almost circumvent and simplify it. Wouldn't it not speed up diagnoses, be able to service more people, and you think accuracy as well in terms of the problematic areas of the domains, or would that still be a psychologist to assess that?
No, there will be a combination of all of those things. And in fact, right now as we speak, there are certain combinations of neuroimaging findings combined with some neurocognitive findings that predict FASD better than just the neurocognitive alone. So we are getting there. By the time you now add, that's why I said with deep machine learning, we are in a cusp whereby there would be easier ways of identifying those with FASD. And that's why we want clinicians to be comfortable with the problem. Because remember, when it has no name, it will not be counted. That's why we need people to be comfortable and identify those with FASD, enroll them in those research so that we can have enough numbers to look back and say, we now know what exactly FASD looks like. And then most of our interventions will actually be refined because of that. So we are encouraging these clinicians to take a deeper interest in the whole area of FASD.
I like that. Be comfortable with the condition. Because when you're comfortable, you're more confident.
Exactly.
And that not only applies to clinicians, but parents as well.
Absolutely.
You know, there's also this Dr. Jody Carrington. She's awesome. She's on Twitter and she does cool stuff. But she says you got to name it to tame it.
Exactly. Without a name, it's like it doesn't exist. So we need individuals to recognize that it is not out of reach for you to be helpful to an individual with FASD. You can increase your knowledge of that condition, which will then improve your comfort level to say, come into my office. I am that door you open to, and I will create a system that looks after you. You may not be the same as the next person with FASD, but now I know what to do with you.
I got one more part from the book, and then I want to talk about how do we get it in the hands. You know, what happens if people have questions about this? Like, what's the follow up? And here's my the last part that I wanted to read. So you talk about treatment and interventions. Good segue. I don't know if you even knew you were doing that, but you did it. The place for innovative clinical services related to prenatal alcohol exposure and its outcomes in the general health system remains unclear. Specific FASD teams assume the roles of assessment and intervention with all ages accept referrals based on the confirmed history of prenatal alcohol exposure. Many of these teams assess children and adolescents and are insufficient with specific issues arise that require the expertise of other mental health specialists. Relevant specialist teams have been formed with over representation of FASD, such as pediatrics, family medicine, psychiatry, geriatrics, and forensic psychiatry. Depending on the healthcare system, professionals with expertise in addictions and developmental disorders also embrace individuals diagnosed with FASD as their clientele. These specialist teams provide a reasonable clinical pathway for patients with FASD. Unfortunately, individuals who do not conform to the expectations of those services are excluded. Surprisingly, many patients fall within this category. They exist in a no man's land.
It is a sad part of the system, and it's not only in Canada, it's worldwide. We're very fortunate to have experts who have refined their practice. There are clinics that are wholly dedicated for people with FASD with a whole team, and they will look after those and provide the best care for those and also consult for those who are outside that. Now, recognizing, as we talked about earlier, that it is difficult to get the system to be at an ideal level, there are many places, unfortunately, whereby individuals with FASD do not meet the standard that is present for those people who have different services. And so they are excluded. We did a study a number of years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago, when we asked individuals with FASD, can you tell us your experience within the mental health system? And one after the other, they gave us this very gruesome ideas and pain of going through a system, and just mentioning the word FASD and the system would tell them, well, we don't deal with that here. So you are seen as being adequate enough to look after yourself when you cannot. You're seen as being not ill enough for a system to take you. Where do you belong? You belong in a place where no one actually provides you care. And so then other places where you shouldn't be, like the criminal justice system, end up being the default. And so in a clinical setting, our goal to the clinicians is to recognize that there are many people who they will want to reject based on what they think the criteria is for looking after individuals that will not end up anywhere but the wrong system. So please, before you do that, think about what you can do as a person with clinical power and clinical skills to be able to help prevent that, essentially keep them within our system and look after them. That's the goal of this. So Jeff, some of it is that we're pleased with many places that have specialized, highly specialized services with those with FASD, and they're doing great. But there are many others that will disqualify those with FASD unknowingly or even knowingly, as we had in our study. And we're saying it's a deplorable condition, is not accepted in this day and age, and we need to do better.
And we're getting there because of people like you doing things like this in the middle of the winter, in the prairie because you know people need to get this info. Now let's talk about getting people this information. So the book is called Prenatal Alcohol Exposure, A Clinician's Guide. You can get it on Amazon. How are we, so what's a parent, because they love to buy the books and they love to give them to the people, right? In the hopes of the reading. What is the parent's pitch when they're going into their clinician and they're saying, hey, I've either got this book or there is this book. How do we close the gap so we get eyes on paper?
First and foremost, I want caregivers and parents to first recognize their own role in getting this book to the first place. It was the voice and voices of parents that guided me to recognize that there were clinicians that were not listening to them. So remember, this is a clinician's guide. It's directed towards somebody with clinical skills, whether it's a social worker, a psychologist, an occupational therapist, a psychiatrist, a family physician, whatever. They are the clinicians. I heard loud and clear in several of my research and work with parents that we have troubles getting this information to doctors. So that's why I decided the doctors need to hear this. Now, you do not give somebody a task without having relational capital. You have to have the relational capital with the person to be able to convey the need for the person to do something for you. What you're asking the doctor to do is one, to acquaint themselves with the latest information about the clinical approaches to people with FASD. You're asking the clinician to consider the fact that this knowledge is going to help them to be better equipped to help people with FASD. You're also, by extension, telling the clinician that if you do this, you are also going to make your own life better and lighter from stress. And so the key point is the relationship you have. Because, you know, if you came to me 17 years ago when I knew nothing about FASD and wagged your finger at me and said to me, you are very, very deficient in your approach, I'm going to become defensive. I'm going to probably walk you out of the office. So we need to establish a relationship that says, look, we're doing the best. You are doing the best you can. I'm doing the best I can. But the client is not moving forward. Can we look at this in a different way? What I think may be helpful is added information. Rather than giving you a hard time, I think you may want to check out what people have written to clinicians, what people are saying about clinicians, and where the book is targeting specific examples of people with FASD. So you can read the examples and see whether they look like your patients or not, so that you can adopt a modified approach to it. So I think this is one of the key things to do. Now, for many clinicians, reading is a part of their second life. They read all the time, okay? Now, if you can provide them this idea of reading as a way of entertainment and knowledge acquisition, you're more likely to gain their own support around that. The other thing that is also helpful is that if, for example, the clinicians think they want to reach out with questions and whatever, you can tell them that I've listened to this guy. He takes emails. He's willing to answer questions. If you have feedback, reach out to him and he will be able to provide that. So it's not really about selling the book, but it's trying to connect with the person to see their need for the book that I think is probably going to be effective.
It bridges the gap. Exactly. The gap, and it speaks their language.
That's absolutely right.
There's a clinical guide that is right up your alley, that's full of information and also clinical vignettes, which will bridge the gap of understanding. It's an excellent book. The entertainment part, though, what do you do? Like, is there something you send where there's a video and you're dancing?
Well, you can say to them that the entertainment part is that they read as part of their life anyway. So
yeah, is that like
I'm not sure about dancing.
Yeah, the bonus chapter, Dr. Mellon doing TikTok.
That's right. Yeah, in the TikTok example of how to do it, right? Yeah. But honestly speaking, like the vignettes are in simple day-to-day language that even parents can tell them an example. Look, I read this vignette, and this is what I think looks like what I'm dealing with here, because all of it is a conglomeration of examples of people who have had problems and people that I've known to have benefited from the services we offered them. So there are success stories, which is entertaining to most people.
And I agree. I agree with you. Your book is people can read it. Like, for example, you do at the start, you do what you need to know, and it's in plain English. And yeah, so for example, one of the big topics that you were talking about, we don't have, you know, I know we don't have time to go deep dive, but so for maternal mothers with multiple exposure to multiple substances. So in your chapter three, for example, you in big bold block letters, you say, what do you need to know? Women using only alcohol during pregnancy is the exception rather than the rule. That's how I learn with these sound bites, just like this, right? The complexity of sorting out the weight and the effect of prenatal alcohol exposure to multiple substances. And then the next one, pattern of use. And then you go biological and social factors. And then, so that's, you put the conclusion almost first, and then the rest of the clinical language just backs up what you're saying. If a parent, anybody can read the what to knows in your book, and they're like snapshots. Yeah, this is what I need to know.
There's also just something, I'll give parents these three key points to consider. First and foremost, at the beginning of each chapter, there is what you need to know. Secondly, there are examples of real life people who have gone through with FASD called vignettes. And under the vignettes, it tells the clinician what are the red flags that will make you think this is FASD. And lastly, if FASD, so what? That's the important question. The last thing, so as I said, first thing is what you need to know. Second is the vignette. And the third one is that at the end of every chapter, there is a practical application. So what do I do next? So this is something that parents can read and understand and even discuss with their clinician. And this is what the clinicians can read and say, okay, now that I've read this, this is what I need to do different, because there's no need having the knowledge without you putting it into practice.
You're the best. You know that?
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate your help. You've been great and helping me with so many things since we met and I kissed the cord in New Finland in 2013.
You remember that? You didn't know
it. That's the fun part.
That's the entertainment part. I didn't know that was you until I saw that picture. I said, holy smokes, that's Mansfield. He's right there. And you're laughing your ass off.
That's great. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Because if you're going to
thank you, Jeff.
You got to do it 100%. I make out with dead fish and you write a 450-page clinical journal on FASD. That's okay. You know, we're all both successful.
We do our best.
Yeah.
Dev, we all do our best.
We're all doing our best, man. It is an absolute pleasure, guys. Amazon.com, prenatal alcohol exposure, clinician's guide, Dr. Mansfield Mella. I will have it on my blog, FASDsuccess.com/podcast. And I can't wait to have you again when I could literally talk to you for 10 more hours, but we all have to eat and sleep. So, hey, will you come back on again?
We will be. You can bet on that. You can bet on that, Jeff. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity and great reading for everyone.
Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate it.
All right. See, told you. The guy's the man. He is absolutely freaking amazing. Dr. Mella, thank you so much. I hope everybody reads the book. Make sure you go out and get it. It is a little bit beefy. It's 457 pages, but man, it's the most up-to-date information. And the goal of this book is about how to interact with individuals on the spectrum and how to help them. And so he talks about so many things. I'll just cover a few things. First, he himself in his story, went 14 years without understanding fetal alcohol, without being taught fetal alcohol. And you know, he was so adamant about how when he listened to that guy say, you know, it's not worth the time to address FASD, you know, that's kind of what triggered him, what called him to action. You know, in a hero's journey, in every movie, there's an event that causes the hero to go on this journey. In this case, to write the book, and that was the case for him, to see his colleagues feel this way about FASD. I didn't know that he ran into some roadblocks with the medication algorithm. See, so the American Psychiatric Association, he tried to get that published and they said no. So to the fact that he's getting this book published through their publishing arm is really amazing. A couple of aha moments for me is about how there were so many compromises made about getting FASD into the DSM. And if he is hopeful about it going from the back page to going into the DSM as a full-fledged diagnosis and getting the recognition it deserves, I believe it too, them. You know, I like how he said the goal is to get clinicians and frontline workers and mental health workers comfortable with the disability, because he talked about looking at the cause and not just the symptoms. He said something so great. He said, once you throw the cause of the problem into the situation, it causes professionals to become shaky, and then it's not what they're used to, and so then their interventions, then they don't really know what to do. So a lot of times when you are advocating to professionals, you're throwing a wrench into what they've known for years and years and years and years, and what the status quo was in terms of treatment for individuals on the spectrum. But we know that it doesn't work that way. It does not work. And he's saying, you know, as clinicians, as psychiatrists, as psychologists, as frontline workers, we deal with the tip of the iceberg. When the rest of the issues are underwater, are below, and I thought that was so pointed, because it's hard. It's really hard, and I know it's frustrating for you as a caregiver when, you know, people won't look at the origin, people won't look at the functioning, what is causing these symptoms. And shout out to Diane Melbourne, who you know, she has the neurobehavioral model, and I remember talking to her earlier in my career, and she pointed out it is absolutely functioning. What is going on with the functioning of the brain causes these cascading effects and the symptoms. Now, if you incorporate the environment into that, it could just compound them, make them worse, but not you. I'm not talking about because of you. I'm not talking about because I believe you're an amazing parent. Just like I think Dr. Mel is an amazing person, an amazing psychologist, I believe that you're an amazing parent. You're doing the best with the information that you've got and the environment you've got it in. Now, the good news is, if you're listening now, if you're listening to 106, whatever the show, an hour and six into the show, you want to learn, you want to get better, you're doing your best every day. Okay, sometimes, right, you freak out and you say something or you do something, and then you feel guilty, so guilty. Stop that. You're human. Stop it. Stop it. You are a human being. If out of every 10 interactions you have, you can have three positive, you're batting 300, and then you'll go into the Hall of Fame. This isn't easy. So that's why you need people around you. You need training. You need to take care of yourself. You need grief and loss work. These are the four things that I talk about from the FASD community of practice that I learned about so many years ago from some great teachers. So that's why, you know, every time we do this podcast, they say get into our free group, facebook.com/group/FASD forever. We got over 4,000 individuals in there. The group is super tight knit. Get in there if you need extra support. And if you're already in there, hey, say something. Say in a post, I'm having a bad day. I could use a little bit of support. Or subsequently, if you have a win, share that too. You know, at the end of the day, man, I love you. And I am proud of the effort that you are putting in, not just because you're listening to my podcast, but I have no doubt you're listening to other podcasts. I have no doubt you're reading and you're absolutely trying to do your best. And I just want to say that I recognize that. I recognize you digging through the trenches, dealing with a pandemic, homeschooling, dealing with mother-in-laws. Sorry, mother-in-laws, I love you, but it's the truth. Sometimes, gosh, you're dealing with all this and you're still coming through. And you're going to make it through. So you don't have to do this alone. Come do it with us. I could go all day and just tell you how much of a freaking badass I think you are. This is not easy, man. This is the hardest job that I've ever done. I tell people in my live trainings, remember when we used to do those? We'll do them again someday. I would sit in front of 1,000 people at these massive conferences and trainings and say, you know, this is infinitely more easy than, you know, spending a week with my guy when I was a foster parent at some point. You know, I'll go on television or do radio or even do this and not break a sweat. But man, you put me with an individual on the spectrum, my heart will get racing. My blood pressure will go up. We're all human. Keep fighting. You're worth it. The kids are worth it. We're going to get through this. Keep kicking ass. I love you, and I'll talk to you next week. All right. Oh, yeah. Get his book. It's $82, but I'm going to put the link to his book on my blog, FASDsuccess.com/podcast. You'll see it'll be the latest blog post with Dr. Mella, or you could Google it by just going to Amazon. Wait, that doesn't make sense. Googling it by going to Amazon. You can find it at Amazon. Just put in prenatal alcohol exposure, a clinician's guide. You'll see Dr. Mella's name. Let's support Dr. Mella. Let's get this book into the hands of clinicians. All right. I will see you next week. We have another awesome interview. Until then, I love you. Bye.